Hello, this is Cliff Moore inviting KPTZ listeners to another fascinating Book Lovers Cafe conversation. Join me as I talk with longtime Port Townsend resident Dot Kelly. Dot is a child therapist, founder of Jumping Mouse Children's Center, and the author of an important new book, Being Found: Healing the Very Young Through Relationship and Play Therapy. Dot will discuss her approach to working with children who have experienced trauma and how she helps families develop a positive pathway forward. Hello, KPTZ listeners. This is Cliff Moore welcoming you to another of the station's conversations with members of our community who are doing extraordinary things right here in our midst. Today I'm speaking with Dot Kelly, a longtime resident of Port Townsend, a child therapist, and most recently the author of an important new book, Being Found: Healing the Very Young Through Relationship and Play Therapy. Welcome, Dot, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Dot, as we get started, I'm going to share a little bit of your background with our listeners so they have some context for this conversation. Dot Kelly has been a child mental health therapist, working with young children and their families for 35 years. She has dedicated her working life to helping young children find their own understanding of their experiences. Dot ran parent education groups while overseeing preschool cooperatives for a college, and in her time with those groups, she learned about healthy development and about the challenges of relational trauma and resulting obstacles to development. Trained in sexual assault treatment, Dot has mentored domestic violence advocates working with children and has consulted in school programs, in interagency meetings with state child protective services, and in court systems. She teaches workshops in clinics and universities about infant trust, trauma, and development. Specifically, Dot has consulted with many parents, helping them bring meaning to their child's own manner of speaking through their behaviors and metaphors. In 1999, Dot founded Jumping Mouse Children's Center, which focuses on providing therapy and treatment for children ages 2.5 through 12 who have experienced trauma. During her career, she has trained and supervised over 60 therapists. Dot Kelly has been an important presence in our community for decades and has contributed to the well-being and the healing of hundreds of our neighbors. Now Dot has published a book on her approach with real-life examples, with names changed, of course, so that others in the profession can gain critical insight into those very difficult situations and help families develop a positive pathway forward. Dot, once again, thank you for being willing to share your story with KPTZ listeners.
Thank you for being here, too.
Dot, can you give our listeners an overview of how your approach works, where you start, your initial assessment, how you engage with parents, and perhaps most importantly, how you work with children who have experienced trauma?
I think in play therapy, where a therapist needs to start is with the parent and the teacher, any important people in the child's environment. We want to get information about what is the concern out there around the child's environment, and what are they seeing that they want our support? Once we get that information, that's sort of tagged and filed, and then we're going to meet the child, because the child is our best informer. And usually what we hear about in our beginning space is we hear about behaviors that want to be changed. And so what we need to deal with is, what are these behaviors really communicating? Because that's the child's primary communicator. So that's where we start, really, is taking that communication that the adults have given and then waiting for the child to show us the meaning of the behavior. So that's the start of it.
So you say the child is the best informer of his or her own situation. Can you go a little bit deeper in that? What does that mean?
You know, once a child trusts the setting, the toys and the therapist, the therapist is actually the biggest tool in the room. And once the child feels that there's something to be had, then the child will open up in oftentimes almost a disorganized way. And the therapist needs to keep welcoming what the child is revealing through both playing with the toys and whatever happens. Like, I worked with one little girl, for instance, who who just stood in the room, and her trauma was quite severe and she was quite young, and she really went into just a still space like you see a deer when you're too close. And that just told me tons. It told me that I couldn't go close. It told me that I needed to be kind. It just told me that I needed to stay with that silence. So a child lets us know, even though the parents may have said, you know, get in there and do something. I wasn't going to do anything except be together. So
you're reading the child's behavior, his or her actions, his or her facial expressions, mm-hmm. the way he or she interacts with all of the objects in the room and all the individuals in the room. You're reading that from the moment you walk in the door.
That's right. Yep.
In the early part of your book, you discuss in some detail the limbic system. Can you explain why the limbic system is so important to an infant's well-being?
The limbic system is the aspect in the brain, or the dynamic in the brain, that is there at birth, and it registers the cueing from the parent, from the mother. It registers safe and unsafe, and it's extremely perceptive in a way. And it will record the infant's sense of safety, which is really about touch and about care and about tone of voice. And that limbic system, instinctual self, really lays the map of this infant who will grow into an independent human being. When an infant is born, there's not really a separation. The baby is an us. And that us will develop. And, you know, one of the great people in our time, Winnicott, said the infant is actually hatched at about 9 months. And that you see that developmentally, that this toddler, this baby, kind of jumps into view and says, whoops, I'm really anxious. I'm here now. So the limbic system is the recording system.
So it's recording all the stimulus that's provided mm-hmm. by the parents or other adults, caregivers, whatever other stimulus might be coming into the child's area of sort of perception. Do they retain that recording, or if the child is recording traumatic experiences, can that recording be erased and re-recorded?
I'm not sure it can be erased, because you're talking about neurology and the firing of that. But I think it's in an infant and a toddler's developmental life, it's very malleable. And that's what we're counting on. I think what happens with trauma is that this limbic system gets triggered and then re-triggered and then re-triggered, and the infant has got to shut it down. And that's what the limbic system does. If it's over hit for what the infant can bear, then that infant has to close, has to shut off, and the limbic system provides that. If that happens over and over, what you're developing in the brain is a more and more brittle system that's going to make up its mind about safety and cueing and attachment, organization. All of it comes from that beginning space of how much and how often. You know, if you have a very, very addicted mother and father, for instance, you are going to be shut off a good deal of the time. And now that's chronic trauma. So, you know, we have these thresholds of information gathering of our neurobiology. And if we go over the top of that or under the bottom of it, we are either over or under stimulated. And that's when the limbic system will shut off the input. It really is an incredible design, if you think about it.
You talk in your book about staying present. What do you mean by staying present? And can you give some strategies for how a therapist works at staying present with a child?
I really think probably the first yes for staying present is to do your own work, because children and their behaviors trigger us left and right. You know, I've had little kids, really small little kids, cuss and swear me out, and they're repeating behaviors that were done to them. But my first reaction is still a bit of anger. And so for me to stay present, I need to not go out. I need to go in to myself. And that takes some training. It takes training to hold steady, breathe deep. All the things we tell children when they're getting agitated, we're agitated. So we go in, we calm ourselves, and then we come back out with a curious self rather than a reactive self. Staying present is probably a key to being a good play therapist, because kids are going to use the same triggers and defenses they've used on everybody else with us. And we hope they do. So being curious and staying there is really, really important. I think the other thing that gets forgotten is to be able to stay present, we have to have our own team, because it takes an awful lot of compassion to stay with hurt children. And if we're not getting compassion, how are we going to give it? And so at Jumping Mouse, I built great supervision. I built consultation groups. I mean, if a therapist needed to have some help, they came into the clinic room and they said, is somebody able to help me? If it was a hard session or a confusing session, that team of compassion lent itself straight into the work with the kids.
What would that help look like? Listening, offering ideas mm-hmm. about how to reach a particular child, or is it just sharing space with the therapist?
A lot of listening that's probably at the top. I think sometimes just saying, "Well, what do you need? Do you have a child in 10 minutes? You got to turn around for? Can I help you clean up your room?" Staying with the same things we do in any good relationship. The outside, you know, the person we've asked for help from is going to stabilize us, because we're wiring and firing together with, let's just calm down together. And that sort of getting together into a mutual thing is really important.
KPTZ listeners, I want to remind you that we're speaking with Dot Kelly here today. Dot is a longtime resident of Port Townsend, founder of Jumping Mouse, the Child Therapy Center, and the author of a new book, Being Found, Healing the Very Young Through Relationship and Play Therapy. And Dot, we're delighted that you would spend some time with us today. You write a lot about memory and how memory impacts development. So specifically with children who have been hurt, how does that memory play into their ongoing therapy and hopefully their eventual healing?
You know, that's something worth writing books about. When we very simplistically look at what's going on, you know, we have kind of this right brain accent and a left brain accent. And the baby and the toddler are practicing and making use of the right brain. And the right brain is all, you know, it's our sacred part. It's where we go and look at art and are moved by it. A child, an infant, is looking at the environment, is being moved by it all the time. And so all that's being stored in a nonverbal way. And that is implicit memory. Explicit memory, more on the left side, is when we're able to tell a story and say, I remember when, or yesterday we did. And really what the adult in a child's life is charged with is building a bridge from the right brain to the left brain. And that is built, I talk about implicit memory actually being implicit reality, because it's ongoing. It's just taping the child's perceptions and meanings of the experience. So the child can go to the store and the mother's upset and quick and says, knock it off, stop doing that. The child will remember going to the store as really upsetting, and the parent will remember it as having gotten through the store. So it's just really, what is the meaning? That's where that child is living, and we access that through their environment, which is play.
And that ability to build a bridge between the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain, do children have that ability at a very young age, or when does that kick in?
It's practiced. I mean, you look at 3 and 4 year olds and all of their, you know, the 2 year old no, and the three year old no, I'm me and I gotta be me. And you look at development and a child is practicing. They don't have it right. Just because they have language doesn't mean they're moving toward logic at all. And that's where we get confused as adults. I think the bridge is in the process of being built, checked, rebuilt, checked. And even at age 7, when a child gets overstimulated, the bridge disappears. And they go straight into the meaning of it, and you're not understanding the meaning. And then they'll behave to let you know you didn't understand. So it's in process. Maybe by 20. I don't know.
So there's still hope for me. Is that what you... Dot, this is, I mean, I'm sure that in your career you've worked with people who have been in very difficult situations, and you write about that in your book. You've changed the name, as I mentioned, changed the names of the participants, but is it possible for you to share a specific example or two of a family you've worked with? And so what were the issues? What approach did you take? And then what were the outcomes?
I worked with a little girl who is 3 and a half, and she was referred to me through sexual assault. And I had a team. I had a really good sexual assault director who would bow her head and say, okay, I'll grant that. And I also had a therapist working with the mom. So the team was really important. And mom was addicted. So this little girl, a primary parent was the TV. And when she first started seeing me, if I tried to discuss anything with her, she would hold out her hand. And this is in the book. She'd hold out her hand with an invisible remote control and say, stop. I've got you stopped. And I had to obey that. I'd plug my mouth up and say, oh my gosh, I'm stopped. And through that, her controlling her anxiety of me and my presence, we worked our way to really, we entered a place where the rocking chair became sort of a doorway to the wilderness. And she was outside in the wilderness, and she was hungry and tired. And I got very, very anxious. And so I tried to save her. I tried to fix it. And so I welcomed her in, and she just looked at me and just deflated, like, boy, you didn't get that one. She was a fierce little kiddo. We did that a bit. I mean, by the second session, I knew I was doing something wrong. I went inside and I addressed my anxiety, and I stood by that little rocking chair door and I said, you're hungry. You look tired. Yeah, she says. And I said, I don't know what you need. And she said, well, some food would help. And so I got her some pretend food, crossed it over, kept her outside. She finally entered into, you know, crossed the rocking chair and came in. And so that's where our trust started. We worked really, really hard together. She was just such a brave little creature. At that point, at 3 and a half, I didn't need to do, because I had another therapist working as a team, and the mom's full approval, the mom was trying to stay sober, I didn't have to do as much of the social work piece that is often required with such young children. But it was remarkable to see how she portrayed the interior, the metaphor of the wilderness. It's right there. Everything you need is right there. Of course, I didn't see it for quite some time because I was so anxious. I wanted to save her. I knew the history and I wanted to save her.
You were trying to fix her.
Yeah, I was. And at that point, once we got there, you know, she started doing paintings and she was really dismissive of danger. And I would just hold the danger and say, I'm kind of scared myself, but you don't seem scared. And she just ventured toward, you know, how afraid she really was. So
how long did you work with this family?
2 years.
2 years. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a moment ago that the mother was addicted. Was this a court-ordered intervention or client, or did the mother come voluntarily?
The mother went into domestic violence for shelter, and they set her up with, you can have this. She had a lot of motivation to try to get sober. And while she was doing that, the work just, you know, we really focused in hard. So she self-referenced. She wanted this little girl safe. She just couldn't do it by herself.
Mm-hmm. And so can you tell us, was she able to attain sobriety?
There were some re-addiction times, but she kept climbing. Her therapist was an amazing colleague.
And, the mother's therapist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she back and forth it. But she did keep the child away from the danger that had been in the house, mm-hmm. which was just random.
And so you worked with this family for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Do you track your clients once they leave your therapy practice? And do you know 5 years later how that child is doing?
In a smaller town, sometimes you do. But this family, they moved out of town. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Any other examples you'd like to share with us?
Hard to pick and choose. There's another little girl. She was about 9, and she had cancer. She'd been a very, very active, very an active child. And the cancer made her just have to lay down pretty much. And so her mom brought her in because of acute depression. And the cancer was entering remission. She'd gone through a lot of hospitalizations. To get into the interior of this child's experience, it really meant that we needed to go down into the toys. And she, at some point, she created this this image, this theme of this really powerful person that she called evil. And the Buddha was sitting behind the problem. And she said, somehow we're going to get through this evil. We're going to get through it. And she created this whole scene, which really was the core of the cancer. And her hope came back, and she was able to draw sort of almost like brain images of that it was okay. Her brain was recovering. And I'll never forget the courage that this little girl had. And I do know that child to this day. She's an adult.
That's very nice. Thank you for sharing that. You know, the title of your book is Healing the Very Young Through Relationship and Play Therapy. And you've mentioned several times in our conversation, she went down into the toys, or she picked out this toy, or she had the rocking horse, or the Buddha, and the representation of evil. Can you talk a little bit about the objects that you work with and how you actually use those and how the children use those to tell their story?
Yeah, you know, in a playroom that Jumping Mouse has, there's representatives of many, many kinds of families, wild families, tame families, kid families, just really. And then there's houses and all sorts of things. A child starts to select things. I oftentimes think it's kind of like going into a bookstore and having a book almost like, go read me. A child has that comprehension. It hasn't been played around with yet. And so they start picking up things and they start creating these stories, these experiences in the tray. In a sand tray. And those stories become very involved to the point where often a child will not be able to tolerate leaving the room. And so the therapist needs to say, you know, these are so important. I'm going to put them up in this box that only belongs to you. And next week when you come, we'll bring it down. But nobody else will bring it down. And so what you're doing is you're communicating safety, because the toy has become a feeling. It's just not a toy anymore. It's actually part of the communicator internally. And you really need to treat that with a sacred engagement.
So describe the toys. I mean, they're made of plastic or wood, or they're representations of animals, trees, nature, houses, cars.
Mm-hmm. All of those.
All of those things.
Yeah,
yeah.
All of those. They're probably, most of them, you want them within like a 3-inch size so that they can, you know, several of them can fill up a tray or not. I mean, I had a little girl whose a sibling had been killed, and she needed finally to hang an angel from the ceiling. And that was just, I hung it. She told me how. She told me how, you know, she was 5. To her, that was a blessing, finally, of something she could not speak about. But she had to bring her caseworker in, and she had to have it examined, because it made so much order out of the disorder.
You say she couldn't speak about it. She couldn't speak about it because it was too overwhelmingly sad for her, or she didn't have the language to speak about it?
I would say both. To say, this happened to me, is too raw for a child. It's almost like, you know, sometimes with little people, we say, look in my face when I'm talking to you. Absolutely not. It's inappropriate. A child is right there with all of their being, and you do not want to force them, whether it's with words or with their bodies, or, you know, it's, be respectful, for crying out loud, because they will become us.
And really, that's the goal of, I mean, I'm one of the goals of your therapy is, yeah, to help young people find themselves and then be able to participate in society and community and make a contribution and feel good about themselves and others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've talked several times about the team approach. Talk a little bit about who's on that team. I'm guessing parents, other therapists in the practice. Is that what you mean when you say the team approach?
It shifts with each child and each child's need and the parent. You know, at Jumping Mouse, we also had a parent. We still have a parent part of it, which is securing connections. And that, if a parent, oftentimes grandparents, need added support to understand this child and their behaviors, they go in to see another therapist, and that's a team, you know, so the adults know that. I think oftentimes it's really wise to have a teacher on board because we can assist in oftentimes the triggers that are showing up in school. Too much noise, too much light, all that stuff creates terrible behaviors. And if a classroom's full of people with a teacher starts to react to those behaviors, that child's going to go downhill.
You know, I can only imagine how emotionally challenging this work must be. After a day of working with families in these very difficult circumstances, how do you take care of yourself? How do you go home and unwind and, you know, be with your people and have dinner and laugh?
Maybe laughter's a part of it. You know, for me, working with young children, it's such an honor. It's just such an honor to be in that interior with a child, allowing for their trust in us. You know, with a child who's in the middle of the process and it's disorganized and dark, you worry that the child can't make a call. An adult in the middle of the same place can call and say, I need to talk to you. So you really do need to have the bridge to the parent. So the parent can call and say, my gosh, they're doing this and this. Where is that coming from? So that you can help the environment in the time that you're not seeing the child. Overall, I know there are times before I see a child where I just, you know, almost like, oh my gosh, you know, here we go. But my evenings, I have a huge garden that helps me a lot. I've always had great supervision and great consultation. I oftentimes was in two consult groups just because I needed those teams to back me up. And again, you know, it's really where when we receive compassion, we get to give it.
In that end, you helped founded Jumping Mouse some years ago, which is still, you know, a child therapy center here in our community in Port Townsend. Can you tell us a little bit about the mission and the history of Port Townsend in the remaining like 2 or 3 minutes that we have?
You know, when I founded Jumping Mouse, my biggest intention was that children needed to be seen and they needed a place that was safe and quiet. And we started with 5 children and not very much money in my house. It started in my home, in my therapy practice. And we started with a group of master level interns in order to see more kids while we got into getting the grants. And it just bloomed. You know, I was raised in a family of 10 and my dad died when he was 41. So all 10 of those people were at home. And I think we were raised on faith. And you know, you're not supposed to talk about that stuff in therapy, but I'll tell you, it sort of runs the show. Yeah.
So Jumping Mouse still working today. Do you know how many therapists are working there now?
I'm not sure. I think there's 10 or 11. It's going strong. I think the latest since I retired almost 5 years ago now, Jumping Mouse has entered the school systems. Okay. And that's just been powerful.
Wow.
Powerful.
That's another part of the team approach.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I just have one last question. You know, if the listeners want to get a copy of your book, how do they do that?
It's on Amazon. My name's spelled with 2 T's, so you could get it on Amazon. You can also get it, I think, through Chiron, which is the publisher that published the book. So, yeah, either
okay.
of those two.
Great. Dot, again, the author of Being Found, Healing the Very Young Through Relationship and Play Therapy. Dot Kelly, author, a longtime resident of Port Townsend, and a saint among us.
Oh, God.
Thank you very much for your time today, Dot.
Thank you for yours.